Hello and welcome to the Barton Legal Podcast. I'm Bill Barton, a solicitor who lives and breathes construction and engineering law. At Barton Legal, we help clients in the UK and around the world on everything from litigation and arbitration to drafting and negotiating contracts. And in this podcast, we unpack the latest legal trends and problems facing the industry, providing you with straight-talking insights to help break down these complex legal questions. So, let's get on with today's episode. Hello, everybody. This is Bill Barton from Barton Legal, and welcome to another Barton Legal podcast. I'm very lucky today to be joined in person. Yeah, I know, another in-person chat, this time with Dr. Zoe Douglas-Judson, hyphenated. I'm just trying to think. I think you might be the first hyphenated person we've had on the podcast. So, and I was saying when I met Dr. Zoe outside, I don't know why, but you've somehow made me feel that each time I meet you, I sort of have to sort of bow slightly as a doctor. Hopefully, you won't mind me calling you Zoe all the way through.
Please do.
I know you're very relaxed. So, how would you introduce yourself to our listeners?
So, yes, Dr. Zoe Douglas-Judson, the longest name I think I've ever come across. Unique name in the world. There's nobody else with that name. And I'd like to think that I'm a little bit the same.
Gosh, that's a bold statement. No one in the world with that name.
Nope.
Wow. No. Have you checked that?
Nobody would be so daft to put those two names together.
Well, I worked with someone who had the surname Judson.
Did you?
Yeah. It wasn't Douglas Judson, but Yep. He was, his surname was Judson.
There's not many of us.
Well, yeah, you're a small band. So I don't go into, you know, too far background, but you, University of Bradford?
Yes.
So what took you to, why did you choose the University of Bradford?
Do you know, I'm a good working class lass from Yorkshire. Really good working class lass. And we'd not done university in our family. I grew up in Bradford, Ripon born, and proud of that. A squaddy kid. We'd never done university. And sadly for me, at 19 years old, we weren't going to do university either, by the way. I fell quite ill with a spinal tumour, which is what changed the direction of my entire life. And ended up, you could only go to your home university then, and we still had grants.
Oh, yeah.
So it was easier then. I was already married, so I married at 19, and so went to the School of Management, as it became from the Management Centre to the School of Management, just because of the disabilities that I still had there. Prior to that, I went to Bradford College, and one of the teachers there, the lecturers there, Janet, kind of spotted that she thought I might be a little bit clever. Took me to one side, didn't have any money for university, didn't even understand that posh lot anyway. She said, well, I'll pay for your application. And my defiant self said, you won't pay for my application, I'll prove it. So I put in my application. Is it UCAS? Is it still UCAS?
Still is.
And I really wanted to be a barrister. That's really what I want. I loved law. Still
love
law.
What a narrow escape you have. What a narrow escape.
All law schools turned me down. The only place to offer me a place was the School of Management, the Management Centre.
Right.
So I ended up doing a Business and Management degree first.
So at 19, you've already packed a lot in.
Mm-hmm.
As a child of as you said, squaddy family, had you moved around, had your parents, because that's normally the way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Army people, families tend to move around. So had you lived in a number of different places before Ripon?
Yeah, I don't really remember the ones before, but Mum's still determined to say that my official name is Zoe with umlauts. I've checked the birth certificate just last year. There's no umlauts on that, no.
They've just been added later. Bit of class or whatever.
Yeah, but that's because I think I was 6 months old when we went to Germany.
Right.
Mönchengladbach is where we were stationed for Dad then. And I'm still not sure what age we came home, but Mum's Bradford born, Dad's a Cockney, so he's a Southern lad. So
that's quite a combination. Do you remember much about sort of being abroad?
No, nothing. Too young. Apparently, I was fluent at the ice cream van.
Okay, and that's a good thing. So your dad's a Cockney, your mum's North. You're a Northern girl.
I am.
Do you think that has helped you by being... Do you think you're more relaxed around people because you're northern? You know, do you think it helps you initiate conversations?
Do you want me to create a divide between your thousands of followers north and south?
I happen to think that a lot of northern people, just for whatever reason, the north has never had that inhibition. I was talking to another guest on the podcast, and I was saying to her that it's the joke, isn't it, about a northern person causing havoc on the tube by saying hello to people.
Yeah.
But there is that element, though, isn't there?
There is a different culture. There really is. You've been to Watford just this week. You know, it changes just as you cross the border. You know, it's a little bit different. I think being northern can hold you back a little bit. I think we are seen as being separate and different from, you know, the epicentre of the world being London. And given somebody that's worked a lot of my career down in the south and particularly London, I think it is a bit different. Sometimes just because we talk different.
Mm.
We just don't sound the same. But I think we have different values and different ways of living, and, you know, the pace of life is different. I don't think it's the same now as it was 20, 30 years ago. You know, we're much more built up now than we were, you know, 20, yeah. 30 years ago.
I think that's right. I'm obviously not a northerner, much as I wish I could be. I'm a Midlander from Birmingham. But I think you're right, there are differences. And did you feel that? Did you have experience of that sort of that difference when you were growing up?
Well, my first voice was a southern voice, so there's recordings of me still sounding more like dad than mum.
Okay.
But I'm an ex-IBMer, so a lot of my global career started with IBM, and it was definitely different. Just, you can feel the difference.
Mm.
I know they've done the science, the studies, haven't they, about which accents are to be more trusted.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say what I think they think about the Yorkshire accent.
Well, no, direct, I've said this many times, direct line based in Leeds because of the accent.
Right.
I was very conscious. I had a Brummie accent. I moved to Lincoln. I picked that up. I moved to Essex when I was young. I couldn't, for the first few weeks, I couldn't understand people in Essex.
No.
And they couldn't understand me. And I didn't even know I had an accent.
No.
And that's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I put in concerted effort to change mine. So that tells you what my belief system was around trying to fit in, or, you know, holding your own within a crowd, particularly in business and management. It is predominantly male.
Yes, it is.
So you
but that's changed, hasn't it? You've only have to listen to, you know, Radio 1 to hear the array of, you know, people they have, the presenters now, and their accents are anything but, you know, what would be termed the Queen's English, aren't they?
I wish I could comment. I can't tell you the last time I listened to radio.
Okay, well, if you listen to any radio...
I'm sure.
I shouldn't be listening to Radio 1. We completely skew their demographic. But, you know, I just like disrupting things. But
yeah.
You know what I mean?
But I do. I think we do have... You know, we used to call my accent more of a university accent where you couldn't tell where the person had come from.
Mm.
You can still hear it. You know, when I'm working down in Kent and London, they know. They can tell.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, in terms of TV and radio, it's not my go-to. I sit and read books and turn into a geek.
Okay.
That's my thing.
But no longer has the... I don't think it's the same stigma sort of north-south now. So
no.
You went into management and you've had a number of management roles.
Mm-hmm.
Why do humans struggle? Why do we struggle with change?
Gosh... Are we talking on an individual level or a collective level?
Either.
Everybody gets comfortable. Nobody wants to change, do they?
Mm.
You know, and the whole survival system is, you know, I think sometimes it's just a bit paranoid, and it just, don't die. So it just wants to stay comfortable. So we stay in our comfort zones and we don't stretch ourselves, and it feels safer that way, even though it's not always safer that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think from really young ages, and I think this is the interesting thing now about the different generations today, is it's we're fear-based, we're conditioned by fear as we grow up. So you look at the, you know, the schooling system, you look at the work system, and everything is conditioned by fear. So it's easy to stay safe. So change It's not comfortable.
And do you think that changes as people progress through life? So do you think that there's, you know, at one age, say, for sake of under 20, do you think you're more or less willing to change than when you're over 40? Or
I think less willing to change. Do you know what? I would say my private practice, the largest majority of people are mid-20s males.
Right.
So I would say that they want to change. They want to progress. They believe in kind of their own natural progression. Over 40s, I think we can get a bit stuck in our ways unless you've got a bit of an epiphany and you go, actually, maybe something can be different. I think it all depends. It depends on the context in which you've grown up in from early years, but also through your career path. And obviously, you know, what traumas hit your life. Mine hit early with a tumour, so it changed my path very, very early on.
And so, I mean, that's a good explanation, isn't it? That we become comfortable and we become afraid of change. So in our 40s, it might be something, as you say, you need, you know, the proverbial kick up the bottom to make you change. But perhaps in your 20s, it comes because you've perhaps left university or you've moved away from home or you've just moved somewhere for a job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's enough.
What is enough? And it depends. You know, we're faced with so much information all the time with our smartphones and things. We see the perfect life of other people on social media. And I just don't think this generation knows what enough is sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I mentioned about the survival system. When you're just looking down at your phone all the time and you're looking at thousands of people and what makes you feel like you belong is very different to our generation and what made us feel like we belonged. You know, I spoke with Dad the other day and he was saying that, you know, we were never in as kids. We were always outside. Mm. So what we needed and what developed us was very different. So a comfort zone and a safety zone was very, very different.
Yeah, and I've talked to people about this as well, that the news is very negative and young people, you know, let's say 14, if you go back 30 years, you just sort of disappeared all day. No one knew where you were. You didn't have a phone. No one.
And street lights come on. You know it's time to go home.
And you drift in and out of people's houses. Yeah. You know, having food, but that doesn't really exist now, does it?
It doesn't appear to. It doesn't appear to. I think we spend so much time on our own, looking down to a little screen.
Yeah.
And we get a lot of our fixes looking down. You know, there's a lot of research around bullying and cyberbullying and why it's easier for online bullying. And I think we've discussed this before. You're not sat in the same room as somebody. You don't see the whites of their eyes.
Yeah, you don't see the reaction, do you?
You don't feel the reaction. The energy changes.
And is that? I think I've read or heard that that's one of the things that those sort of cyberbullies like, is the fact that they don't see the person. So they're not actually the recipient of or see what the recipient feels, and therefore it enables them to do it because there's no sort of tangible sense of guilt or the impact that they cause.
I don't think they get rewarded the same. So a bully traditionally at school, when I was at school, they would feel the reward of releasing whatever the energy they need to release, the kick back that they're getting from, you know, bullying someone. Whereas now I think it can go on and on and on longer because they're not getting whatever the fix is that they might be.
They do it longer because there's no immediate comeback. So they're looking for something that they can't get.
I believe
so. Oh, I get it. Okay, yeah.
I'm not saying that that's definitely a fact, but I think it's certainly, you know, a potential there that there's something that they've not got in their life for the need to feel to share that negative energy.
But it's also difficult because people return to their phones, don't they? You know, the victims, you get hooked, not on the bullying, but they're hooked on their phone. And it's very difficult for particularly young people to actually get away from their lives being conducted on their phones. No.
It's a great fix. You know, it sparks off all the dopamine hits that you need, and it's a great fix. You know, why go outside and go find something when you know you've got immediate gratification? And it's a bit like what we were just saying with the bullies. What's the reward? Were you getting a reward while you're looking at your phone?
Yeah.
You know, whether that's pushing for likes, you know, on your Facebook, your social media, or whether it's just looking to distract What, the boring? We're not very good at being bored as humans.
Is it difficult now because there's this impression, there's all these influencers that you can do things without sort of the hard graft? You know, does that impact on sort of this as well?
I think it does, because we see the polished article, don't we?
Yeah.
And we see a lot of the polished articles. But I think for some people, don't forget, we went through a wonderful time where, you know, we could just sit there. When The Secret came out, the laws of attraction, and everybody misunderstood and thought we could just sit there and keep our fingers crossed and wish for better, wish for bigger, without putting in the work. And then, you know, it's progressed since then. And I think when you look at an influencer, let's not forget they've got, you know, particularly if we're looking, say, on Instagram, they've got lights that they've already invested in, that they've already set up. We've adjusted the mics here today to get the mics just right. So we've got a perfect situation. But me, the observer looking in, doesn't think about what effort, what time, what investment went in to that
already, yeah.
Nobody sees it.
Yeah.
So because everybody just wants immediate gratification.
Such
it's a natural
shame,
human thing.
Do you remember your first phone?
Yes.
What was that?
Nokia. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Small one.
Yes.
Like curved. Yeah. I've still got a Nokia in my desk drawer at work. I don't know actually why I kept it at all, but yeah. So
you got a secret little burner in your phone.
Sort of burner, yeah. Just in case everything.
Just in case the world
but
ends.
But you had to sort of press the button three times for the letters. Do you remember that?
Yes. Well, long before the days of, you know, not being able to use your phone while driving, I could drive and not even look by feeling my thumb across the and knowing roughly what would go.
I had a I had a phone with a, I can't remember what it was now, a little it had a little rollerball, and I loved it, and I found it.
Was that
recently.
The BlackBerry?
It's a little tiny BlackBerry.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it's called, but it was sort of miniature BlackBerry. And it was great. And I was, like you say, I was really quick at it. I tried it the other day and thought, how did I ever use this? It's just such a pile of junk.
I know.
You know, and then you look at, now you've got, people don't even think of it as a phone, do they? Because it's, what's its primary function? Is it a phone or is it a camera?
God. Well, I thought it was a music station, though.
Or a music station.
It kept me away from Radio 1.
Oh, well, it could be.
It's interesting. I was speaking, my son's just turned 30, and I was speaking with him the other day, and there was something significant happened in his life with, you might not like to hit, Sheffield United,
okay.
After he turned down Leeds United, by the way. And I just bought 100 text messages with the, you know, touch three times for each letter. And I remember sitting there sending my friend this text message going, who's ever going to use this when he can just pick up the phone? And now, I don't really pick up the phone, I'll send a message.
Yeah, it's hard to encourage people to pick up the phone. I notice it when people say, oh, I will phone them rather than you know, email. Because you now have to work on encouraging people to remove or move away from the default of just sending an email or text.
Yeah, you do.
What was it that in your career moved you from working within, you know, change management and different companies, and you went to the Leadership Centre, Leeds Met, you had other strategic roles. What was it during that made you realise you wanted to be in charge and was it something about being in charge or did you feel that was having your own company was the only way to really start to make a difference?
God, that's fascinating. Isn't it funny what people observe and interpret? So from that CV of Zoe's life, what you don't see is a bit like the fake imperfect on the social media. Honestly, there was a life event. I was working away global a lot and came home one day, finally got the kids to the dentist because I was never home in time for the dentist, and they both needed four teeth removing.
Wow.
Oh, I cried for hours, and thought, my first job in this world is to raise these two kids safely. And so that was it. So stop travelling, stop the southern kind of career routes, and started to try and make it on my own in the north. which is very different.
Yeah.
Very different because, you know, people weren't spending the same as they did in the South. We know that rates are very different in the South as they are in the North. And, just got onto the kind of the circuit of networking and building a business, but it was not easy.
And was that difficult as a woman, you know, doing that? I mean, would you say that you haven't had sort of problems, or would you say that you... I always think, but it's very easy from an external position, I always think that women have had to work harder to get to the same position as a bloke.
I can only speak for myself.
Yeah.
I can honestly say, during that time, and we're going back just, you know, a few years, I think it has been harder for women during my generation. I think it's... I wouldn't say it's easier, it's different now. But as a single parent woman trying to make it in the boardroom, I remember one client first after leaving, before I joined IBM, trying to go it alone before I joined IBM, yeah. And thought, this is just too hard. And I took in, Bookaroo. Do you remember the game Bookaroo?
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, how am I going to convince eight, you know, predominantly, I think they were all white middle class males in this board, that I should come in and help them with the strategy of their business. I'm young, I'm female, and it brought all of that. So we played Bookaroo in the boardroom to teach them metaphorically what was going on in their business so they could understand it in a different way. The 80% of that meeting really was about, hey lass, what can you teach us about our business?
Right, yeah.
That's what it was about. What could I really give them? I mean, I was still early 30s at that point, so I knew I had to do it different. So I had to, you know...
That's an incredible learning curve, though, for you, even though you wanted to do it, to have to work out and navigate your way around this.
Everything's a great metaphor. So from the wrapping to the instructions to the, you know, it kicking off too soon. And what you're doing, you've got a safe space to discuss what's the problem in the business.
Right.
And it's not, it stops pointing the finger of blame and it goes, this is what goes on for us. So you then come together because you're not talking about specifics. You're now connecting.
Yeah.
And that's really what happened with the board, was to be able to go, right, we can understand this different. But it goes back to, when we go back to survival systems and, you know, me as an individual versus us as a collective, is about where we feel safe, but it comes down to trust.
So that must have been quite a weird feeling. So you're going into a job and you know
pitching. You've got some... I've not even got the job at this point.
And you've got a Bookaroo in a bag. Mm-hmm. As you're walking in, were you saying to yourself, girl, you're like, this is crazy? I mean, can you remember the reaction of their face when you put Bookaroo on the table? They must just like, okay, next.
Absolutely. But what other chance did I have?
I'm
kind of under the average age of the person pitching for the work, number one. And I'm female, number two. And you do feel it. So what else could I do? You've got to do something different. You've got to do something a little bit out there. But interestingly, you know, behavioural science is still quite a new concept. And what we've got are traditional methods of changing and developing a business. So you can't get out of the problem with the same level of thinking that got you in there. So you've got to change the thinking.
But that's a...
And the energy.
That's a really interesting point, because I don't think any of us, you know, how do you describe then what a behavioural scientist does?
I don't know about anybody else. I just know what
I do.
But
what would you do?
A bit of witchcraft, as you would know.
Yeah.
So I blend lots of different schools of thought to become a behavioural scientist. So the only long posh word that I know and I retained was a phenomenologist.
Okay, that's... Phenomenologist. That's...
Phenomenologist. So I can accept human phenomena as truth, as fact.
Yeah.
I don't accept that just because it is, it always will be.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start looking at the social sciences against some of, say, you know, biology and physics and things like that. So I'll bring together, you know, the world of business, quantum physics, biology, you know. So I look at individuals and the collective individuals, you know, from a physical, physiological and psychological standpoint. In my private practice, most people come to me because they believe that psychologically something could be better, something's not as good or as strong as they want it to be. When I'm working in a business, it's the same. I use the same analogy of the human self to the collective selves of the business to start to work. So for me, behavioural science is about the environment. It's about how that environment impacts us and how responsive or reactive we are to that environment.
And so when you're talking to people, how important is it for them and for you that they've already acknowledged that there needs to be a change? You know, is there a difference between someone's sitting there thinking, well, we could do with a change, and someone actually, you know, positively embracing it? And presumably you go places and people have sort of... Well, do you go to places where you think you're going in and actually you're thinking the first thing you've got to do is break down that resistance?
Okay, so you talk about a collective in an organisation.
Yeah.
You've never got 100% of people 100% ready. So with anybody, company or individual, sports or business, it's always about readiness. I can't wave a magic wand.
You can't.
But it goes back to what you asked about the effort. Mm. Do people want to put in the effort for change, or do they just want to be magically there already? So when you look at a business that's ready for change, or you look at somebody, an elite athlete that's ready for change, the word ready is absolutely critical.
Right.
Because a lot of people, if they're not ready, then they're always looking in their environment and pointing out, and they'll play victim with themselves.
Okay.
You know, I can't do this because of that, or the pickup labels.
Okay, yeah, okay, you know. Yeah.
So for me, it's always about readiness and that resistance. So a company can say that they're ready to grow, for example, or, you know, somebody's ready for a world title, but are they really ready to do something different? Because if it was already there, they'd already have the result.
And is it hard to get high-performing people to be introspective enough to look at, you know, that question of, am I ready? Do I know what ready is?
I don't think anybody sits there and goes, am I ready, if I'm honest. To be introspective, you've got to want something that you don't have. There's got to be a desire level. There's got to be not a need, but a desire level, a want for something more than what I've got today.
Right.
And I think some people... I've got a client at the minute, and they're really good. They'll go out and say to people, you really need to spend some time with Zoe. Was I looking forward to a blueprint and 4 hours with her? Absolutely not. Kept putting it off. Because people fear what they may find.
Yeah.
You know, I was listening to something just this week about feeling significant, and it's about the dating world, and it's about, I would fear any guy having to go on a date with me. Because if you feel like you're being analysed all the time...
Yeah.
We kind of get lost in ourselves. We don't want to look internal. We don't want to think that we got it wrong. So when somebody sheds a light and somebody goes internal, they're fearful of what they might have missed, because we don't want to feel like a failure.
But that, it's sort of a contradiction, isn't it? Because we don't want to necessarily look inside, but anybody who wants to change, whether it's grow or perform, has to have that element, don't they? And they have to open it up for somebody else to do.
Not everybody knows that.
And is it something that you, when you're working with people, you know, in sort of simple terms, you're sort of saying, right, you've got to do this and recognise it? Or are there the tools that you use as, you know, lots and lots of open questions to make that person suddenly think, oh, you know, there's like the light bulb moment over their head?
Yeah, I think there are lots of tools. When you ask me about being a behavioural scientist, and that's the blend of everything, it really is like a witch's cauldron for me.
Yeah.
You know, we're putting in bits of everything. When you look at change, traditional change in a business, you usually have a wonderful project plan, and it's got everything and everybody in there. But what's not on that project plan is the bit that I tend to do. That's the magic between. That's the invisible energy. That's the life force of what enables or disenables change to actually happen. And that is a lot of, can I create enough desire in someone, in a collective, to want to move forward? And it comes down to, it goes back to your survival system. What's in it for me? Is this rewarding to me? Do I get something out of this? Or am I just going to resist it? Is it valuable or important enough to me? Or do I just not want it? You know, and that takes us then back to our human belonging and our collective and communities. It takes us back to my survival system. So there's a lot that actually goes on with when you look at resistance for change and whether you can enable it or not.
And presumably, when you're working with particularly companies, you're having to imbue this across a group.
I know.
Because you can't have... How do you cope where you've got a group, and I presumably you must have occasions where you've got sort of one person either, let's say, lagging behind or sort of willfully lagging.
Yeah.
How do you balance coping with those two? Because that's quite an extreme if you've got...
So if you've got a group of people, never expect 100% of support. If we go for 100%, then we're faking perfect. Again, we're back to that kind of world. If I spend all my energy focused on the one person that's lagging behind and not on the rest that are enthusiastic and are open to growth and change and stretching and going forward, I don't want to lose my energy to the naysayer. Yeah. That's for them to want to join, you know, that group, that collective. But if they don't believe that there's enough in it for them... So, and if they feel that they can get away with it as well,
right?
We can be really lazy as human beings.
So by sort of pandering to that, then you can cause a problem. So it's more about making the collective so attractive to that other party that they want to catch up and join in.
In my younger days, I would have spent all my energy trying to get 100%, and I can tell you, aiming for 100% is about my ego and my needs. If I'm looking after an organisation, I'm looking after the collective and the joined up vision of where we're actually going to go. And if we've got a naysayer, maybe that naysayer's done their journey and they don't need to be there any longer. They get to decide how long they want to stay.
Yeah.
And not everything's forever. And that's part of the problem that we've got in society now, is we try and make everything forever. And, you know, not everybody's supposed to see the journey right to the end.
Yeah.
We've all got our own individual journeys. So that's why I don't take that, you know, push all of that energy. I've got to be careful about my ego in that situation.
I think that's a very clever point, but I hadn't thought about that before. You're quite right that aiming for what is seen as potentially success, you know, the 100%, is about sort of the teacher, the leader, as opposed to what is realistic in a group or organisation or a group environment, where actually as long as the majority get it.
Yes.
And is that something that you are conscious of sort of explaining to organisations at the beginning, that, you know, you've tasked me with this, you know, we're not going to get 100% people, but...
I can tell every single client is so uniquely different. There is no one shoe fits all policy, and everybody's at a different kind of stage of progression in getting buy-in and commitment to any kind of level of change. So it all depends on where they're at to be able to take them forward.
And do you think companies are more alive now to the need to change, or do you think there's a difference between companies? Do you think, you know, you... I'm not saying you could sort of, well, you know what a phone book is, but I mean, if you had a big list of all the companies, you know, do you think it's sort of just a 50-50, or do you think some areas of, you know, say, do you think professional services are different from manufacturing or sport? Or
it's a good question. They've all got human beings in there. So for me, it's no different. The toolkit, whether I'm working with, you know, a world title holder or whether I'm working in a startup business or, you know, a mature business like you've got, you know, there's still human beings in there, and they're all on different stages of their journey, collectively and individually.
Yeah.
And it's about getting as many of those majority to go collectively for the one shared goal and vision.
And do you think companies are more... I'm not sure if the right word is alive or alert, perhaps they're the same, to the need to get the majority of their workforce moving? with them?
I think traditionally, back in the day, a lot of business principles came from the military. So it's a very command and control approach to the workplace and to performance and to success and outputs. And we did do it different back in the 80s. I mean, you know, we removed the dartboards and the pool tables and the social spaces. We removed the tea lady and we removed all of the human elements. But prior to that, it was all factory, all industry based. Whereas now when you look, that sense of aliveness, we're starting to put those things back in because we recognise the human connection. Mm. We recognise the, you know, the belonging together in that kind of way. So I think we're now much more of a inspiring influence.
Yeah.
I think we've lost a lot of control. And I think particularly those that I work with that are of my generation, we used to, you know, we come in early and we leave late to prove that we're dedicated and committed to the firm. And I think we've lost some of that. And I think some of that's good and some of it's bad. If we added up how many hours we ever gave for free on our career path,
oh yeah,
which is tantamount to theft, really, in a sense of
sort
hours.
Of, yeah. So I see where you're going. I see where you're going. But, you know, I think you sort of sign up for different. But you're quite right.
But now, you know, there's a lot of people won't give an extra hour without being rewarded for that extra hour. They won't go that extra mile.
But that comes without. That comes across in lots of different areas. I see that both in my area in law, but I also see it in trades, where they talk about the difficulty of, you know, young people and saying, you know, I'm going to pick you up this time, and I'm like, well, I don't start till this time, or the boss will say we're here till we finish, and the person's saying, well, I finish at X o'clock.
It is more like that.
But and I love the fact that you talk about the removal of things, you know, dartboards and that, and you mention tea because tea trolleys and things. There's so many things that, when I'm talking to people on these podcasts, different ages, your different backgrounds, your different geographical locations, you have had different educational experiences, different family experiences, all the rest. And I love the fact that within all the podcasts, little things frequently crop up in different areas. And
we all talk about the tea lady, do
but
we?
The tea lady, it is. You know, I was talking to John Tack about this, the tea ceremony, and when I was at Edges a long, long time ago, we had a woman who came round with a tea trolley, and it was brilliant because everyone stopped and there was a little bit of passing of gossip, and you know, I found out that she had plates of biscuits, and so I found out that, you know, helping her and taking a couple of mugs to people, you know, I'd get a second attack at the plate of biscuits. I must have passed it on to my son. And when I was in hospital a couple of years ago, they'd reintroduced the tea lady in hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And these are social phenomena that break down barriers.
Yeah, they are.
Aren't they?
You know, there's a lot of science done around, you know, like the water filter, you know, the water fountain office. And I know we've discussed before about hybrid working and people, you know, whether they're in their office or not in the office. It's back to that human connectivity. I was just writing down some words so I didn't forget, you know, when you worked out how to influence the tea lady.
Mm.
You know, we talked about the command and control versus the inspire and influence. You know, you wouldn't have put that on your change or motivation or achievement success plan. But yeah, internally, you knew how to work the system.
But I knew how to be, you know, charming to her. I wish I could remember her name. But she would always stop and have a chat because she knew I'd have a chat.
You
and I'd
help
say,
her.
Oh, look, I'll take some mugs around for you. And she knew that she could have a little respite, you know. And it's
our
ability to look after people, though, isn't it? Doesn't it take much.
But it goes back to what we talked about before, about people's desire to change and things like that. What's in it for me? You gave her something. You rewarded her. You gave her respite.
Mm.
And you were given a respite because you wanted something back.
Yeah.
So that exchange happens.
Well, I think
charm.
Isn't one of the problems that we're not honest enough sometimes, that we always want to portray that we're giving. You know, we want everyone to think, yes, I give, I give, I give. You know, oh, I do all these things. But, you know, if we were more honest.
Mm.
We do things, and you know, I know you do things, and we all do things, and we say, I don't want anything back. And it's not about in some of the things, no one's going to, you know, give you money, and no one's going to give you a big tick. But you, what you get back is you feel good, and you, it can't be denied that if you've done a charitable thing, somebody else might say something, and you'd say, well, actually, you know, actually, I did this, and it gives you that little buzzy feeling, doesn't it? It makes you, you know, but we need to be more honest.
Do we?
I think so. That
about what?
About the way we exchange. We're humans, and I think...
So we want to... you think we should reveal to everybody else
no,
what
I'm
makes us feel...
No, I'm not saying you should reveal. I think that internally you need to have an honesty that, yes, we all do things, but, you know, there are some things that you might portray... as I do this for no reward.
Yeah.
But you give yourself a positive, like, yeah, I did that. And that's fine. I'm not in any way criticising.
The problem is people don't know their reward systems.
Mm.
They don't know what makes them feel good. They don't know what makes them feel significant.
Why don't they?
When did we teach them?
Do you need to be taught?
Well, when you look at... when we become adults, we've all got an inner child. These are repeat patterns of behaviour.
I've still got mine.
I left mine in the other room. We've all got an inner child, and we don't know what the unresolved issues are. So we look like we're cheering someone on, or we look like we're being charitable, but actually there's always something we want in exchange. There's always a return. We are inherently quite selfish, but we're just blind to what's driving that selfishness. There's a really good positive art to selfishness.
Yeah.
You know, selfish is an ish. It's not self. It's ish. And if that works mutually between you and an exchange with somebody else, that's absolutely fine. But that level of honesty that you're asking goes back to what we discussed about being brave enough to look internally within.
Yeah.
We don't know what motivates us a lot of the time.
And is that because people don't stop to think? People don't give time to just, you know... chill and spend time. I was talking to Joe about this. Spend time on your own, that sort of internal sort of contemplation time.
I think the world can go so fast, and we've got so much noise that we just don't bother to take the time sometimes.
Yeah.
But I just, you don't know what you don't know.
So how do you say you like reading?
Yes.
So how do you? Because your job's incredibly hard, because you're asking people to open up and to move, but you can't say, right, I want you to move from A to B. You've got to find a way to, you know, open questions.
And
encourage that movement from their own. So how do you sort of de-stress? How do you unwind and sort of give yourself that time to contemplate?
Gosh, I was speaking with James earlier about Buddhism, so, you know, I do practice.
Yeah,
those,
you're Reiki as well.
Yeah, I am a Reiki master, so, you know, I believe in energy. I'm an introvert as well. A lot of people don't know whether they're introvert or extrovert.
Mm.
People think because of my job I must be an extrovert, but I'm not. I'm 51% introvert, according to the last check.
Okay.
So whether I'm meditating, whether I doodle a lot, so
okay.
I can, you know, create wonderful drawings and pictures. Well, they're wonderful to me. So that's how I will... When you say... How did you phrase it? How I switch off?
Yeah, how do you give yourself the downtime,
okay,
that sort of battery recharge as a human?
So the question is in two parts there. There's the physical self that just needs to rest, but then you've got your psychological self. And most people that say about recharging is really about switching the brain off,
okay,
which is where meditation, breathing, you know, even havening, everything can really work to kind of quieten the mind in that kind of sense. The physical self, we just see it as, you know, go and have a nice relaxing bath, sit down, stop moving. But switching the brain off is much more
challenging. It's very hard. I like having a bath, but I'm just within, like, I like the idea of a bath, but the trouble is within about a minute I'm bored.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll get a bath and I'll put I like bubbles. You know? I like bubbles and nice smell.
You're painting a great picture now.
But I'll put a towel on the side of the bath and I have a book. And so I'm going to read. And I lie there. And after about a minute, I just can't.
Yeah.
It's too relaxed.
No, you're conditioned.
So talk to me about Recce and how... What is a master?
Oh, God.
And should it be called master? Should it be called mistress? Or should it be called something else?
I don't mind that it's called master, if I'm honest. It's, you know, we master the art of things, so I'm happy with that. Recce is about energy. And for me, that's going back to quantum physics.
Right.
And, you know, we're 99.99997 or 8%, something like that, nothing.
Right.
And when behavioural science progressed, when the sciences progressed beyond physics as we've got it, you know, as we originally had it, we discovered that we are nothing. We're energy. We're life force. You know, the old sciences would say that, you know, anything we couldn't understand, we put down to God.
Yeah, true.
Whereas now we understand.
Some people still do.
Yeah, some people still do. Whereas now we accept that we're energy. We're 70-odd% water and we're pretty much nothing. So if you start to look at Reiki, it's just simply understanding, you know, the energy fields and being able to work with the energy to shift out what gets stuck.
And is this energy fields and lines in your body as well as those outside and the interaction?
Yes. Everything's got an environment. So the cells have got an environment, your whole body's got an environment, this room's an environment. When you start looking at interacting with the environment and changing the environment, then you can shift energy along.
And does Recce look at, because it looks at categorising us into different types of people, or are we all in Recce just the same, but we have different levels of energy? Or?
I don't categorise people into different types through Reiki, I've got to be honest. What I'm looking is for trapped emotions. We can do it remotely.
Right.
I had one wonderful case, somebody that was with Arsenal Football Club, actually, out in Hong Kong. And, you know, they were going through an interesting negative emotion and shifting their energy. And, you know, that was really quite powerful and profound. And the impacts of shifting that. A lot of that was the fact that somebody was listening.
Yeah.
I truly believe.
And is that a difficult thing as well for people to listen? You know, I was thinking, coming back to, we've become dependent on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And we've become dependent on a certain method, is that right, of information being given to us. So is it harder now for people to listen?
I think it is harder now because we've got more distractions now.
Right.
We've got... They used to say that we had 70,000 thoughts a day.
Okay.
Which is interesting because I don't know how long a thought lasts. So that's, first of all, how I'd go. I'm not sure I can kind of agree with that. If you're dealing with 70,000 bits of information a day and now you've got smartphones, which we didn't have, I think it started off as 20,000, then they put it up to 70,000. How can you be listening when you're never present?
Yeah.
So, like, we're doing this podcast now. I'm trying to listen to you at the same time, remember everything that you're saying, and give you interesting information, some interesting facts and you know, bits of. So, am I truly listening in this moment? Well, I'm not fully present because I'm thinking about giving you something of value.
But that's the way. Surely that's the way it's always been with human interaction. It's just the extent to which you can cut off or exclude the extraneous distraction so that you can focus. But
we're just gathering so much more. There's so much more going on now than what there were. I mean, we connected with so many more people than we ever were.
Oh no, God, tell me about it. My daughter's getting married and she says there's 160 people who are all close friends. I know, really? And then her fiancé had a 30th birthday at the Brudenell in Leeds, and they're like 60 people. I couldn't have 60 people if I invited every single person I knew. And this was just like a small gathering. Yeah, people are way more connected now.
So you imagine now trying to listen when you've got so much more going on. There's just so much more. It's not just about, you know, walking back from school and all the things that happened, and I share with my parents when I get home, and, you know, in the 70s and 80s. Now I've got, well, I probably didn't even see what happened in my external world because I was so busy walking down the
that's
street.
That's an interesting thing, isn't it? People are very, as you say, looking down.
Yeah.
But so what was the worst piece of advice you've had? I mean, you know, best piece of advice is not interested. What was the worst piece of advice you've ever had?
I could be really cynical and say you should really go on a second date.
Okay, that's good, that's good. And what's the worst piece of clothing? I don't know why I decided. I was writing down some things and it's just I thought, oh, no, I had worst piece of advice. And then most embarrassing piece of clothing that you've ever bought.
Oh.
Or owned. I'll front up. I was talking to someone earlier. It was a green Marks and Spencer's kit.
Wow.
That's mine. Mm. There are photos that still need to be destroyed me in that.
The worst outfit was my upper school uniform. It was burgundy. I can't wear anything burgundy.
Right.
I'm a golfer and I found some lovely golf clubs the other year and unfortunately they were burgundy, so played well with them. I just couldn't look at them.
Then that's spooky, you see. This is because my next question was, what is your favourite club? As in, from a driver through to pitch.
It changes. It was always the 7 or 8 iron.
Okay.
At the minute, I've got a magic club in my bag and it's the 5 wood. And it is. It's like a wand. It's magic. Or it's just having an evil day and it just doesn't want to get out of the bag.
Golf's like that, though.
Golf is like that.
I think golf has some sort of karma that you're rubbish. And if the more rubbish, I think the better you will play on the 17th and 18th, yeah. Because
you suddenly
think, oh my God, we've been too bad to this person. We want them to come back. They must have an amazing 17th or 18th. How many times has that happened to you?
That's all the time. That's what it does. Albeit, you know, I play very calm, as you can imagine.
But oh, I bet you do.
I did listen to Sean Connery the other week on a podcast. Or on something, I don't know, one channel or another. And he said, golf is the only game where you can see what's going on in somebody's life by what game they're playing. He said, you can't hide out there. You take it with you.
And
whereas I escaped to it, so...
Do you think you are that calm person?
Yeah.
Do you never lose it? Have you never smashed your club into
never.
The ground?
Never. No, the worst it gets
is... Do you think
is,
you're missing something? Do you think you should try that? No.
Why would I put that energy into my system?
Oh, that's quite. No. It's quite releasing.
No. Well, you know, and some people it is releasing. My golfers, I teach them to walk like Beyonce.
Oh right, okay.
So
love
for
that.
Me, yeah.
Love that thought.
For me, the worst it ever gets is DJ.
Right.
That's it, and then it's gone.
Yeah.
But you know what we were saying about looking down to the smartphones. A lot of my golfers, I'm teaching them to look back up to get the chin up because
right.
The body knows. The body listens and it follows the instruction. If your head's down, you think about when you watch football, God, his head's gone or his head's down, you know.
But it is.
You lift your head up.
Golf is a particularly, I wouldn't say, but it's an easy, people understand. You have to be very positive, isn't it? And it's that image of, you know, when someone's got a chip over a pond or something, you've got to create that image of the ball landing on the green and not think about...
Bob Rattel is brilliant at teaching you all of that, you know, where you want the ball to be.
Yeah.
And it is in part about positivity, but it's a bit back to what we were talking about with the change in organisations. It's always back to trust.
Yeah.
If you're not trusting, if you're not enjoying, you're not going to follow.
Yeah. And what...
You're not going to... And that means follow through.
And what are your sort of favourite bits in terms of when you're working... with clients, is it the sort of going in and you know your pitch? I don't know if you still use Buckaroo. I mean, I think it's a brilliant idea.
I haven't used it since EasyJet actually.
but is it still the first time you go in and speak to the client, or is it now the outcome? You know, you sort of when you finish and you think, you know, I've got 85-90% yeah. or what are these people?
I feel like I'm being awkward when it's right in the middle. It's when you're in the thick of it and when there's chaos and they've already tried 10 different things before you've arrived and you just got to be patient and you've got to observe and you've got to wait to find what's missing. The beginning bit is still difficult for me. The pitch is still difficult because you don't know the level of somebody's understanding and belief about what I do and how I do it versus what they've done,
yeah, I suppose,
and the cynic.
Yeah.
And you can accidentally find yourself trying to convince somebody at that point, and that doesn't really
work.
That's
working too hard then, isn't it?
Yeah.
And can you see, with your experience now, do you, can you sort of see the journey more clearly, or when you start, is it still...
You can see it all too soon.
That's amazing.
You see it all too soon. 26 years in business, you're going to see, you've seen a lot. You know, no two businesses are alike, but you've still seen a lot. And, you know, my biggest failing in IBM was trying to take clients too fast, because I could see.
Okay,
and I didn't want them
to
trip up. I didn't want them to have the mistakes. But yet there's value and benefits in allowing you to trip up.
It's very hard, though, isn't it? Because you're in a business where actually... an element of people getting it a mistake, they will learn. In my business, we're no longer allowed even the slightest mistake. And it's a massive contradiction, because on the one hand, I have to be right, and so do all
that's
my,
what they're paying
team.
For.
But it is what they're paying for. But then you have to look at the ultimate, a judge.
Yeah.
A judge can be wrong, because you have a higher judge, you know, the next level up. And so you can end up with seven or eight judges on a case where they're completely different views.
Yeah.
And so there's a massive contradiction in law with that. But it's a different thing, isn't it?
They say there was... a famous thing in engineering, the Tate Bridge disaster years ago, and they said that engineers only learn through failure. It's interesting. I've worked with a number of lawyers now where, what in my practice, we'd class it as a trauma. So there's been an event, something's gone wrong, and then there's been an audit or an investigation about what's gone wrong. And I've worked with several now that would avoid a certain part of their role or their area of law where it's gone wrong before, because it's felt so bad.
Yeah.
Because you train so much to be right. And getting over, you know, certain clients coming in and there's an email there from them, it would trigger. And I can relate to it massively. Back in the days of the financial crisis, you know, when I set up on my own, we went through a really, really bad financial stage. So every time the postman came and I heard the trigger of the post box going would trigger me back into, you know, seeing all the red letters and all of that fear. So when I've worked with certain lawyers before and something's gone wrong, but it wasn't just them, but how they can over personalise, something's gone wrong, and now we don't need to keep living history, which is what a trigger does. It takes us back to history, it takes us back to that painful point. And the survival system says, I don't want to feel that pain, so they won't open the email.
Right. Yeah.
So how can they progress if they can't own the mistake that was made?
That's a very difficult thing. And how about you, Zoe? You take on huge pressures and you listen to people's, you know, problems. Is it the meditation and the Reiki that enables you to rise above it, because you're an incredibly positive person. Well, you are an incredibly positive person. You know, you smile and you're super chilled, and yet you're taking on and dealing with all these pressures of other people.
It is such a privilege. Okay, so when I work, because I work with individuals and then collectives that happen to be part of a business or something else. Okay, if I meet your energy, I'm giving you sympathy, or I'm joining you at your pain level, that's not going to benefit you. So on one side, and I always do this with people, on one side of your shoulder, you've got your inner critic, the bully, the one that's going, you're rubbish, you failed.
Know that one.
Yeah, we all do. My job is to train your higher self, to constantly lift you up, to get balance back into your life. So if I meet you at your emotional, negative self, I'm not helping you train
that
a stronger version self.
Positive.
But plus, when I'm working with you as a guide on energy, my job really is to help you recognise that. But I'm not emotionally attached to the outcome, so I can see things more objectively.
Right, okay.
You feel it subjectively.
Yeah.
I'm training you objectivity to get balance.
You make it sound so easy.
It is so easy.
Okay, my final question, can you bake?
Yes, I can. No, I can't. I'm shockingly bad. It's funny. I've just bought, it's Valentine's this week, and I have to pick up the strawberries. I've been and bought 6 massive bars of chocolate to put this box together of strawberries dipped in chocolate to look pretty.
Okay.
Because I can't bake. There's no way. You don't want one of my buns or cakes.
No. Okay, well, I'll bear that in mind.
Yeah.
Zoe, it's been just such a beautiful time to spend with you in person.
Likewise.
Again, you're a wonderful person. I don't know how you managed to take on board and help people grow and remain so chilled yourself, because, you know, I have stuff and I'm going to be like, you know.
We all do.
Clearly, your meditation and that and Reiki is something that works for you. I'm gonna start handstand classes. That's gonna be my next thing with my wife. We're gonna handstand classes and that, because you're meant to be amazing.
Well,
for sort of relaxation.
Can you do
a handstand?
You know that I'm learning how to do handstands. So I am midway through learning how to do handstands, and it's about, when you get to my age, it's about staying flexible and strong. Yeah. It's really about stretching that comfort zone.
But you love it, though,
well.
Don't you?
I absolutely love it. You know, there's the physical change that you can see, but what you can't see is the invisible changes.
Well, this is great, because we're going to be able to compare our handstands.
Superb. Soon. Well, I think I'm a little bit behind. I did get a bit of envy when I saw that the group class was already upright and I was still only...
Oh, well, I'm
there.
Just worried about getting off my knees, but we'll see.
It'll be good for you. It'll do you the world of good.
Zoe, thank you so much
thank
for coming
you.
In. It's been lovely to see
thank
you and chat to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for today's Barton Legal podcast. Please make sure you follow the show in your podcast app to get new episodes as soon as they're released. We'll be tackling another important topic in this month's Barton Legal webinar. And you can register for free and watch back our previous webinars at bartonlegal.com. Why don't you connect with me on LinkedIn and follow Barton Legal to keep up to date with all the legal trends and news? I look forward to speaking to you again in the next Barton Legal podcast.